The Mayfly is up, the four words that spark excitement and magic in a fly angler's mind. And it's that time of year when the Mayfly is indeed now up on the jewel of Irish Lakes, Loch Carb. So to get a taste of how the Mayfly action has been so far this year and to find out why it's such an important time, both culturally and economically for local communities, we're joined on this episode by Roy Pierce, the well-known angler, guide and owner of Grasshopper Cottage on the shores of the lake. But Tom, before we hear from Roy, I believe it was he who was actually responsible for your career in guiding.
Yeah, hi, Derry. Yeah, it was. A while back now. It's nearly 30 years ago now. I just come back from a year away. I was in Germany, in Berlin. I just arrived back, and I think it was the first night, and I was in one of the local pubs just sitting down. And bear in mind, I didn't know what was going to happen or what I was going to do. And I'd known Roy because he'd been here a good few years. Well, he'd been here about 5 or 6 years at that stage. And he came up to me and he knew I was a keen fisherman. He says, are you doing anything tomorrow? I went, no, I'm not. And he says, you'd never be able to bring two guys out fishing. And I just looked at him and I said, sure, I've never done that before. He said, it'll be grand. Just go ahead. Grand. Oh, you know where to bring them and everything. And I said, but what? And he says, I have a boat engine. You just bring them out. And so I said, all right, I'll try it. And that's where it started. I remember I went out that day and we had a couple of fish, which was great. It was in April, I think. So it started from there. So I've Roy to thank for my career.
For ruining your life.
Yeah.
But I'm fascinated because you said before, your dad got you the boat when you were 13. You know, you're on the lake all the time. You were fishing all the time. And, you know, Carb is such a busy lake when it comes to visiting anglers. Like, 1 + 1, like, did it never occur to you, go, geez, I could make a bit of money here guiding, because you were just too busy just fishing for yourself? Like,
yeah, it's got, when you said that to me, I had to think, and yeah, no, never crossed my mind. I suppose, like, because my dad didn't do it, actually, you know, and it just never did till that evening. No, maybe I always thought it would have interfered with my fishing, but yeah. As we discuss on it there later, for when I started my first couple of seasons in Mayfly time, I remember dapping in the middle. So yeah, but no, never crossed my mind. Amazing, yeah.
Tell me this, actually, it's an interesting point you made, because people might hear, oh, you know, the guiding life, you're out in the lake every day, you're with people, you're helping them catch fish. Like, it obviously interferes with your own fishing, doesn't it?
Yeah, straight away. To be honest with you, I think we might have done it in another program or said it. First lockdown, when there was no visiting anglers, was the first May I'd fished for an awful long time. I don't get to fish in May at all. Like, okay, that first couple of years, I used to dap in the middle. I stopped that soon enough. It's not, you very rarely see a guy dapping in the middle now. So yeah, no, I haven't fished Mayfly at all. You don't get to fish.
Are you kind of like, start of the season, end of the season, maybe, you know, the downtime, maybe that's when you try and get a bit of fishing done then, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, the busy times you don't. I mean, you know, that's part and parcel of the job, you know?
Yeah. And do you nearly feel like, you know, when you're so busy at this time of year, the last thing you want to do is go fishing nearly, like?
Oh, no, because it's completely different. Sorry, yeah. I really enjoy my job. I really enjoy guiding, but it's completely different. Now, maybe I'm able to compartmentalize or, you know what I mean? Yeah. You know, it's after a lot of guiding, I would find a great way to relax to go out and fish myself.
Yeah, because I suppose people forget like how intense guiding is, because A, you know, you're trying to put people on fish. The conditions might be great. You're having to weigh all that up. Where do I go? What kind of conditions it is, all that kind of stuff, how good the anglers are. And then you've got the social side of it as well, where you're having to, you know, be the chirpy, happy, you know, chatty.
Yeah, there's actually, I often think there's... There's a bit of entertainment there. And then you have to realize sometimes you have to temper it, because, you know, you don't want to be chirpy, happy, talking all the time in the middle. So, yeah, there's a bit. Look, every guide is different. And that's the beauty of it, because it's not just all about a guy putting you over a fish, which is very important. Don't get me wrong. And then there's all the other things. And it's how you get on, there's personal relationships. And I've seen it here with all the different guides we've had here in Duras. And there's different guides for different people. You know, I remember one particular guy who's quite stern, and some guys like being with him because he would keep people on their toes and they'd find their fish better with that. None of those other guys who just couldn't hack that at all. They'd say, no, no, no. And they go for the more lackadaisical, easy guys. But that's, you know, there's a whole, there's a book there, really, you know.
There's a whole psychology to it.
Yeah, no, there is, yeah. So, yeah, no, I really enjoy it. But it's, like, look, like anything else, and as I say, I enjoy it. It is a job, you know, it's a job. You've got responsibilities and it has to be, tasks have to be performed. But I enjoy it. I have to say, I do enjoy it.
Let's hear from Roy Pearce now, Tom. And I first asked him how the mayfly season has been going so far.
It's been a patchy, but it started early. The water was low. We had a warm winter. It's hard to describe why it started so early, but because of low water and probably water temperature was up a little bit, it started in around, I suppose, the 24th of April, which, you know, sometimes you wouldn't see it for a week or 10 days after that, you know. Because of that, it's hard to determine. I mean, years ago, we would never have come here before the 17th of May. You know, you're looking at 2 to 3 weeks earlier than tradition would have had it, you know. But I'm going back, I suppose, a little bit longer than you guys. But
has it become less predictable? Like, you know, in years gone by, it was a kind of, you could set your hat by a certain date nearly, but has it become, like you said, sometimes it's earlier, sometimes it's later?
Yeah, it's probably been coming progressively earlier through the years. You know, I'm talking maybe 10 days earlier than on average than it would have been, let's say, 50 years ago. Now, you could say that's down to general global warming, or you could argue this, that, or the other, but there's no doubt about it. We've not had, in the west of Ireland anyway, what I would call a proper cold winter. I mean, there was no ice on the lake at any stage this year. I mean, years and years past, they used to cycle across the ice to the land shore, you know.
We've only had one night of frost here, Roy, over the whole winter. You know, isn't that about it?
Certainly, I would always have gauged when the mayfly would start by a very well-known old Gilly Paddy. Somerville used to have a lilac tree in his front garden, and I always used to say, when that comes into bloom, then the mayfly would start, you know. But everybody has their own little, the white thorn, the what have you. But I mean, blackthorn is only literally just finished a day or two ago, and next thing, the white thorn is out. Rarely, if ever, do the two ever come together.
Does that affect the fishing in any way when it comes that bit earlier?
No, I can remember excellent years when it went from duck fly straight into olives and then into mayfly. The fishing didn't seem to be affected adversely at that time. So I don't think so. The answer is I don't know.
And Tom, how have you seen it in terms of the fishing, like, you know, yourself, you know, the last few weeks?
Yeah, what Roy said there, one word describes it all, patchy. Really patchy, and exactly what he said. It's been up since the 24th, Roy, as you said there, and you know, you're thinking it's gonna start now, because normally when it comes up you expect it to come on full gusto, but it hasn't, Roy, has it? It's just been dribs and drabs and pitter patter, you know.
Yeah, I thought Inchigill is an interesting case in point. There was a big hatch down there apparently today. Now I would normally never go near Inchigill for another 2 weeks.
The end of May normally, Roy. Once it finishes here. Once it finishes here, we'd go off to Inchigill.
We'd go off to Inchigill. But I still think there's probably quite a lot of fly to come here. I'm always reminded of John Reddy Sullivan, who told me of a year, now this must be, I'm talking 60, 70 years ago, when he went out on the 24th of April, managed to get a box of mayfly and caught 4 fish dapping. And in the exact same year, he went out on the 24th of June again, with a box of mayfly and caught 4 fish dapping. So there's a full span of full two months there. So it's not unknown that it would be protracted and dragged out.
Is it frustrating for the anglers maybe now that are coming, because you're saying if it's patchy, you know, you can't, it's, and it's not as predictable. So the anglers are coming, is it mayfly season or not? Like, you know.
You know, there's a famous old saying, is they should have been here next week. And that really puts it in a nutshell. You know, you should have been here next week, because you really don't know.
Yeah.
You really can't predict. It's down to conditions. Sometimes conditions will dictate whether the angler is successful or not. But it does seem over the years that there's been a shift. I mean, years and years ago, we have what's called the North Lake and the South Lake here. Fishing the North Lake would have been considered inferior to the South Lake in those days, but that maybe 15, 20 years ago changed in the reverse, and then it became fishing for mayfly became better in the North Lake than the South Lake. And certainly the South Lake seems to be recovering over the last 2 or 3 years. Now, whether that will continue or not, it's hard to know.
Where's the dividing line actually, just between the North and the South?
Political disputes, I'm not into.
Just say peninsula, right? Peninsula will do.
Yeah. I suppose if you were to say, I would have said the outside of Inishturis and Canaver Island over to the Glan Shore would be north or west or northwest of that would be actually the South Lake. That sounds a bit of a conundrum, but that's the way it is, yeah.
And tell me this, how has it been? Obviously, it's been tough, you know, with the COVID years, Roy. But are you starting to see numbers starting to pick up now? Is there any sense of kind of, you know, that mayfly season, that buzz of, you know, the season when the anglers are around? Like,
oh, there certainly is. I think there's a pent-up expectation of people who've been waiting for nearly three years to come back fishing. I mean, sadly, a few of them haven't made it, right? Literally, you know. But there seems to me to be a greater interest from Irish home anglers at the moment than I would say there is from UK or continental anglers. I think they've been a bit reluctant to travel. I think travel has been difficult up until relatively recently. They didn't know whether they had to quarantine. They didn't know this, that, or the other. So it's really put a bit of a dampener on people traveling overseas.
Must have been very difficult for you, like, you know, running the cottage, like, you know, in terms of obviously you had to shut down, anglers couldn't come visit. Like, were you kind of crawling the walls, or did you find it actually relaxing and having the quietness and the lake to yourself? Like,
it was, I'm very fortunate. I can manage normally to get away in the winter time, but having to spend a winter in Cornamoon, it was dire. Yeah. No, I'm not used to that. And with the pub closed as well, it was double diarrhea.
That was a double whammy, Roy.
Double whammy.
at least when you are here for those winter months, you know, you can go down and talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, at the moment, to answer your question, normally we can have 5-6 rooms, but we have to keep rooms available at the moment just per chance anybody gets COVID. And so we're only operating sort of a half blast at the moment.
That's a fair point, actually. Yeah, you don't think of it like that in terms of, needing that in case somebody does need to isolate or anything happens like that. Like,
we have no choice if somebody's staying here from the UK, which most of our people or many of our people are. You'd have to accommodate them as best you could.
Tell me this, Roy, that's not a Cornamoan accent. How did you end up with Grasshopper Cottage on the lake shore of Carrowbleck?
Yeah, well, I'm originally from North County Kilkenny. My father was what would have been called a duffer. He was a keen enough sportsman all round, but he really wasn't a fisher, an angler as we would know them today. But he really enjoyed going out there and dapping. And we came here. I first came here as a child. I remember catching my first trout with my father here when I was 8 years of age, presenting it to my school teacher back in Kilkenny, and she trounced me the next day for not getting two. She wanted her friends to have trout as well. In those days, they were prized eating. They wrapped them up in dock leaves and sent them by train from Mount Cross to Kilkenny, and they'd arrive the next day, you know, they'd arrive the next morning, which is hardly possible even today. It's hard to believe that, but that was the fact. They got them to the train at Mam Cross at about 4 o'clock or 4:30 in the afternoon, and they'd arrive in Kilkenny next morning.
You know, you got the bug as a kid, but like, I'm presuming, like, was a fly fishing career on the horizon for you, or what happened?
I mean, as a child growing up, visitors to the house back in Kilkenny would say, "Where's Roy?" And all my mother, oh, he's on the river. I lived by water. I lived on water. I caught fish by all methods, legal and illegal. I just grew up with fish, you know. But I mean, I had another career as a builder in Dublin for some 20 years. And then out in the recession in the early 80s, we had to change tack. And I took up, I basically established, I suppose, at that time, a travel agency specializing for fishermen. Because I was coming here right through the troubles in Northern Ireland and everything, and noticed at that time that English anglers, of course, weren't welcome anywhere in Ireland during the troubles. People forget that. I mean, they were spat at, their cars were slashed, their tires were slashed. It was a nasty time in Ireland, north and south. So all those traditional anglers from the UK just upped and left. And it had somebody, it wasn't going to just recreate. Once the chain of repetitive visits to Ireland was broken, they just simply went to Scotland or they went elsewhere.
So how did you bring them back?
Basically, I set up a travel agency. I used to stay in an old bed and breakfast house here in Durris at that time. And they said, "Oh, it's a great pity the English anglers aren't back," and all the rest of it. I said, "Well, is there anybody trying to get them back?" So at that time, there was a fellow by the name of Brian Geraghty in Bord Fáilte in Dublin, who was a keen angler. And we put together packages going to England on promotional tours, putting on slideshows and film shows and what have you. And gradually but certainly, we attracted various fishing clubs from the UK, some of which are actually here now for the 30th year, actually here with us today.
And is that a big part of it, the carb for UK anglers, like that a sizable chunk of the industry per se in terms of the visitors, that it's very dependent on the UK market?
Yeah, you tend to forget that the biggest business in angling in Ireland with the UK was not in game fishing, it was in coarse fishing. And the Midland lakes and rivers were a mecca for English anglers for years and years and years, primarily because in England they had a close season for fishing for coarse fish, which we never had here. So in their off season or their close season, they would all come to Ireland to do their fishing. And it was huge business. I mean, massive business down lanes. But you talked about fortune. Game angling was very much the infant of their angling promotional work. It was Brian Geraghty and a fellow by the name of Paul Harris, who was the UK angling representative within England. He was based, I think, in Coventry or somewhere like that. And he was extremely instrumental in putting together these shows, getting angling clubs throughout England, putting on a slideshow, and sometimes there'd be spot prizes. And maybe there might be half a dozen operators from Ireland, including myself, there trying to attract people. But in those days, we used to run a full package. They liked everything packaged up. You know, the ferry, we dealt with the ferries and the airlines, and we packaged the whole thing up and made it look very financially attractive, I suppose. But we put people all over Ireland. I mean, it wasn't just Corrib, it was from Killarney to Donegal.
And tell me this, when was the peak, would you say, in terms of the numbers? Like, has it been kind of dropping slowly kind of in the last two decades, or?
It certainly has. It took a couple of years, obviously, after the troubles in Northern Ireland for things to pick up. I suppose the peak was in around the mid-90s. 95 to 2000 was probably the peak of it, you know. What happened after that is difficult to pinpoint. It's the old... There was a great tradition of whole families would go on holidays, and they wouldn't go for 4 or 5 days. They'd go for 2 weeks, sometimes 3 weeks. You know, it was they'd come with their own cook and what have you. They might rent a house, or if they were, depending what type of accommodation they wanted to to end up in. But I mean, I put people in everything from Ashford Castle to camping in the garden. It was good. Unfortunately, it all came to an end.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, Roy. I'd forgotten, but I remember you telling me that about how you would create the whole package for somebody back
That's right.
then. But that yes. doesn't really exist now. Probably maybe due to the internet or whatever. But
what happened to me, or to us, should I say, I mean, it was primarily, I established a travel agency whilst I was still living in Dublin. And what happened afterwards, after about 5 or 6 years of operating quite successfully, putting people all over there, is the European Union, in its infinite wisdom, decided to make the agent who was dealing with these liable for all occasions. And of course, from when the client, as it were, left their front door in England or Germany or wherever, and until they got home again, the agent was liable. And of course, that required massive insurance bonds, which we could never actually afford. So we had to pack up the travel agency business.
You know, you'd have the colonels or the judges or, you know, these kind of professions that could take off for a month or two, you know, and that was the thing. They'd come down and they'd fish it hard for that time. And really, you know, they'd move lock, stock and barrel.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I mean, I remember non-fishing wives sitting reading library fulls of books whilst the husbands were fishing. Yes. And of course, the ladies used to fish too, which you don't see as much of today as we used to see.
But is it, tell me this, is it, do you think more, is it like people are kind of more nearly doing day trips now, Roy, that they kind of just come up, you know, they do the, like obviously within Ireland, you do the day trip or maybe a weekend trip from the UK, you know, like Tom was saying, you do your, get your information on the internet, get the boat across or whatever, or drive across, and it's in and out nearly like, is it?
I think the whole culture of particularly fly fishing and game fishing was very much the preserve of the more upper classes, as it were. And that has changed. There's no doubt about that. Now everybody that wants to fish can fish and does fish. And I think those very wealthy clients that we used to have can now, the world is their oyster. They can go to Russia or they can go to New Zealand or they can go to Canada. It's not quite as closed as it used to be, you know. But you look at the history of a lot of the old fishing lodges in Ireland, they're nearly all have connections back to the UK.
Yeah, that's very true. Tell me this, and even Tom, actually, you might tell me this kind of when you were growing up, was, and is this still practiced, where the kids would catch the live mayfly and sell them to the anglers? Does it go on anymore? Like?
The kids in certain parts of around Cora, but particularly Oughterard area, used to get off school for the week or 2 weeks to go and collect mayfly and sell them. You could drive through Oughterard in the early hours of the morning from 7 o'clock to 9 o'clock, and the boys would be standing there waiting for you with their boxes of mayfly. I think it was important pin money too. I mean, it doesn't sound a lot, but it was, I think, an important source of those extra pennies in those days. Yeah,
it wasn't as big here, Roy. And I just wonder, when you used to be in Bayview, what was there anybody there? Was there any the youngsters that would be selling them to your father? Do you remember?
Well, Connor was the first one who arrived occasionally, but. Generally speaking, no. It wasn't the same tradition in Corona that you had in Oughterard or Headford.
Yeah. I suppose probably because Oughterard had a couple of the hotels and the houses and probably more people. Like we didn't have, we had a few guest houses here, but we probably didn't have the same number really compared to some place like Oughterard.
No, we didn't. We were much more remote. It was harder to get to Cornamona than it was to the other places. But I remember my father used to always fish Loch Derg for a week before coming up to Loch Corrib. Derg was always earlier in mayfly hatches, and he would bring his mayfly with him from Loch Derg.
Would he bring the mayflies up from Loch Derg, yeah?
Oh, yes. He'd always arrive up here with boxes of mayflies, yes.
Do you remember Frank Diskin telling us that? You hear the time. Frank Diskin told us 1 year here, and he reckoned it was about back in the 60s. Frank Diskin has passed on now. He was an old boatman. He worked for the Inland Fisheries Board Trust. But he said there was no mayfly here for one season. Do you remember that, Roy? And they actually drove down to Carra, the boatman, every evening to collect mayflies.
I actually did that myself.
Did you?
We actually travelled from Bayview with Edward, beating the bushes around Loch Mask, and even venturing once to Loch Carra, which at that time had a prolific mayfly hatch. It's also coincidentally happened in more recent times with the olive hatch, where we had absolutely no olives whatsoever. And everybody was saying, oh, that's the end of olives. We'll never see olives again. How could we? And the very next year, there were olives galore here.
I remember that. That's only a couple of years ago, Roy.
It's not that long ago.
Yeah, that's all. Yeah, no olives whatsoever. Mm. And there was olives in other parts of the lake. But the olives up here in Dours, gone. Just gone.
Didn't happen. Amazing how localized. Yeah, the hatch is, isn't it? Like, you know, like, people underestimate, I think, how important mayfly season was to the economies of local communities. You know, in even Uachtarard, you know, I love driving through these places at this time of year because there is a real sense of atmosphere. And I can only imagine what it must have been like 30, 40, 50 years ago. You know, that real sense of, you know, I remember we were talking, Tom, before to one of the old guest house owners down the road from it. And they said it was a time of year that they stopped pretty much the farming, you know, because pretty much, you know, that's how you made your money for the next, you know, month or 6 weeks or whatever, like that. People came in, it became the guest house, you know, and it was an important additional income for them. Like, and I think people maybe kind of, obviously that's kind of dying away now, that the importance of the local economy, isn't it?
What do you think, Roy? Still a fair bit comes in.
We were trying the other night to work out how many pints of Guinness the group from UK had drunk in 30 years.
Oh, go on, say the Tunbridge crew. Say the Tunbridge crew. Go on. Don't hide the fact. Sorry.
We worked it out at about 6,000 pints of Guinness.
In one season? That's not bad.
No, over 30 years. That's only six nights. But, I mean, it was big business. Of course it was. I mean, the whole economy perked up because from the grocery shop to pub to you name it. And, you know, when I think back on it, fishing wasn't the be-all and end-all of trip. My father used to persuade all his local mates back in Kilkenny, now, come on, you can join us. And most of it was for playing cards. 25s and game of solo was very much top of the agenda. And of course, if the weather wasn't perfect, they simply didn't go fishing. They went to the circus in Ballinrobe, I remember one year. And, they used to go to the race. There was a race meeting on. That took precedence. If there was in Ballinrobe or even Galway, they went to the races. You know, it was they were a bunch of lads in those days. Yeah.
Does the buzz still come when you hear the mayflies up? You know, is there still a kind of sense of anticipation and excitement?
I think generally speaking, anglers look forward to the mayfly because it gives them an opportunity to use all different methods for catching fish. You know, it's the fish just go feeding, and once they're feeding actively, more easily caught. I won't say readily caught because they're not always, but more easily caught than at any other time of year.
And dapping, is it still done? Is it still popular? Or?
Yeah, not as popular. I mean, angling methods have progressed and changed over the years. I mean, when I first came here, dapping and trailing flies, as they call it, was our brackeen fishing. That was it. There wasn't anything much done besides that. But nowadays, there's such a difference in methods of catching fish, and a lot of advanced techniques have developed over the years for winkling them out, much to the disgust of some anglers, but other anglers, it's really worthwhile.
It's a beautiful sight, I think, you know, when you see the angler sitting in the boat. I don't know, there's something poetic nearly about it.
Dapping demands a level of concentration which isn't really demanded from other techniques. If you're not watching that fly all the time and know the procedure for hooking him, you'll miss him, you know, he'll be gone. You won't be there. Whereas with wet fly fishing, you can pull, but you wait for the fish to tell you it's there. It's too late in dapping. If you felt the fish, he's either hooked himself or you've missed him, you know. But it demands a concentration, which to me is probably the most relaxation, because you can't think of anything else. You know, if your mind wanders or you look around you, you're doomed to disaster. You know, it's pure concentration. And I mean, Sorka, my wife here, she's wasn't nicknamed the deadly killer some 40 years ago for no reason at all, but she could outfish me 3-1.
Dapping, it's not unique to Ireland, is it? Was it in Scotland as well? Was it in England as well?
It's in Scotland. It's unique. Well, Scotland has dapping as well, but Scotland, they don't dap a natural fly. They dap heavily dressed Lahordis or other type of flies. But with us in Ireland, it was always more traditionally a live fly, be it mayfly or daddy long legs or grasshopper.
So which would suggest then that dapping maybe originated in Ireland then, did it, do we think? Well,
the style of dapping from a drifting boat, I would say, between here and Scotland, probably, yeah. Yeah, I of course, as an Irish person, I claim that it was
we'll
Ireland.
Claim it, we'll claim
yeah,
it. Anyway.
We'll claim it.
And it never went to England, did it?
No. No, they have a form of dapping in England from the bank, just poking a rod through, right? And, you know, dapping it on the surface. But from a drifting boat, no, we'll call it Irish.
Yeah.
When we were on about it there, and I was going to mention it to Roy, and I just remember about the end of it, because I did it initially when I started boating. But definitely, Roy, when you'd been coming up here first, the boatman always dapped. The boatman always fished with the two clients.
Yeah, but dapping allows the boatman to do that.
Yeah,
you know, he has one arm on the oar and he has one on the rod, and of course he can maneuver the boat. If you know, we see when you're used to fishing a lot, you can see fish ahead of you that the angler, by and large, misses or doesn't see. So he can quietly push the boat one way or another to suit himself.
That's only a wild, scurrilous rumor, Roy.
I dapped with probably the most effective dapper that I ever came across, which was John Reddy. I mean, he just simply never missed a fish. He had the uncanny knack of being able to dap about half the distance that I would dap and still catch more fish than the guy either side of him, you know. He presented the fly in a particular way. It's not just everybody can dap, but to become an exceptional dapper is different than that. There are certain people I know who quite simply don't miss fish, which is unheard of by most dappers.
I suppose you don't get a nickname like the Deadly Killer or the Great White Shark.
Or the Great
Undeservedly. No. Yeah.
No. No.
What, tell me this, right? Is mayfly season, is it your favorite time of year on Corrib?
Yeah, I mean it's years ago it would have been a clear favorite. Now I have a couple of other periods of the year which I really enjoy, but it's normally because it offers me top of the water fishing. I'm very much, as Tom will tell you, somebody who rarely uses anything but a floating line, and only then in competition or something where I feel honor bound to do something better than I am doing. But it offers top of the water fishing. I mean, there are periods of duck fly time which does that. It can be superb as well. And I really enjoyed the back end sedge fishing, which unfortunately last year was very disappointing.
I'm always interested in kind of looking to the future generations, and in terms of kind of what you think we need to be doing, I suppose, to kind of preserve Corrib as the kind of jewel in the crown for wild brown trout fishing.
I think that people's expectations through the years, I remember going to game, as I said earlier, going to game shows in the UK, and at the end of the day, remember now I'm talking to an angling club that are generally fishing stocked waters, and asking, generally speaking, now tell me, what would you expect to catch on not Corrib on a good day? How many fish would you expect to catch? And they'd look around at each other and say, I don't know, bag up at 7 or 8. And I remember clearly saying, the day you catch 4 good trout on not Corrib, you've had a good day. And that was the time when the size limit was 12 inches, not 13 inches or 14 inches, you know. Count statistics are very misleading because we're not always comparing like with like. But I do clearly remember saying that and watching the faces drop. What, only four fish? I tell you, if we could average four fish now, we'd be counting ourselves very lucky indeed. Don't forget the change in the size limit. We actually keep a record with the Kent group because traditionally they only measured, when they first came, they measured 12-inch fish as a capable fish. And then the size went to 13 and made a substantial difference to the catches. So we kept measuring fish just out of interest to see how it compared between the 12-inch and the 13-inch limit. And it was substantial. I mean, the catches really were reduced by, I would say, 60% between 12 and 13 inches.
Yeah, it's very true, Roy, because remember we've discussed that because our hospice competition, which we run on Catch and Release, is the old 12-inch limit. And sometimes there's actually 40% more fish in the overall return for the competition. Not often, sometimes it's up 30%, but all because the limit is lower. And it's very true that you say that. We've always said that. We're both singing from the same hymn sheet here, Roy. It's changed the mindset, and people don't appreciate a 12-inch fish now because it's not that people are throwing all the fish back, but it's in the mindset, oh my God, this 12.5-inch fish isn't a keeper. So I'm discounting it. And like we know, Roy, sometimes getting a 12.5-inch fish can be just quite a challenge. You can cover them out the side and everything. So, yeah.
But when I was manager at the Costlam from oil fishery, we used to measure every single fish that was returned. These are sea trout now. And there was no size limit on sea trout. And some of the fish that came in, I mean, they were pathetically short. I mean, they really just went with a piece of rasher on the frying pan, you know. And remember, I can't remember personally, but I do remember big catches when we first came here, when the limit on Loch Corrib was 10 inches. And that remained so for several years on Loch Conn afterwards. And Loch Conn then got the reputation of being a much better lake than Corrib was. They put the size limit up on Loch Corrib, but they didn't put it up on Loch Conn at the same time. And suddenly Loch Conn got the reputation of being a much more prolific fishery than Corrib, simply because of the size limit.
Yeah, it did, didn't it? Very much so. Yeah, and just bigger numbers. But if you look at, there was a sizable amount of those fish between 10 and 12 inches.
Yeah. You forget, too, that, even today now, if you go to Fish Killarney or somewhere, you're fishing for much, much smaller fish. When I first went to Fish Killarney, I thought, gosh, this is a very disappointing place to come at all. But not appreciating that the fish genuinely didn't grow that big there. And that they were good fish in their own right. They get spoiled by Corrib. We're used to big fish.
That's a good one, isn't it? That's a good line. Yeah, we're spoiled by Corrib, you know?
Yeah,
it's the quality. Are. But you guys would be biased anyway.
Of course we would. No, not really. We're completely neutral here. Actually, speaking about fish, Roy, we ask you, size of fish, your most memorable one. What's your most memorable fish? Is it from Corrib, first of all?
No, it isn't. And it's a very long-winded and very unlikely story lies behind it. So I'm not sure that we should record it here. But
I think we should.
I think we should, yeah. Sorry.
Do you? Okay. I'll try and be as brief as I possibly can. Growing up in North Kilkenny on what was then a very prolific small trout stream, there happened to be a timber mill on the side of the river, and the toilet of the timber mill overhung the river, to say the least. But in those days, going back to what we called dibbling, which is the English version of dapping, we used as kids to dap blue bottles underneath the trees and the bushes. But there was this particular trout underneath the tree, and the only way I could get at him was to put, this was maybe some 10, 12 feet above the river. was to put the rod down through the toilet seat and dibble the blue bottle down below. And I did actually catch it. It was a massive fish. It was a pound and a quarter, which was a huge fish for that river.
Did you catch it through the seat?
Through the seat of the trolley.
It was definitely a fish.
But it is the most memorable. Yes.
Memorable in more ways than one.
Yeah, I know, but there you are. You did ask which was the most memorable.
We did.
But a bit of toilet roll, it was the fly.
Yeah.
Oh, that's brilliant. But,
no, I mean, when you talk of memorable fish, generally people go to size big fish. And I've been very fortunate to catch a couple of very big fish at Corrib through my years, yeah. On fly. I think one particular one that stands out was one that I hooked at Cassidy's Point and landed in Schoolhouse Bay. It had to be, it was a bad, poorly conditioned fish, but in a good condition, it must have been 16, 17 pounds weight. But it barely weighed 11 pounds at the time, but it was some tussle, yeah.
Well, that's some image to finish on, I think, Roy. Actually, no, sorry. The fish from the toilet is actually staying on my head. Not the 16 pounder.
You see, you shouldn't have phrased the question. The most memorable one.
Well, yeah, no, if we did ask memorable, we did not mention biggest.
And in fairness, that's why we ask it, because, you know, memorable can be defined in many different ways.
Yeah, but it's very true, actually, because, you know, it's not always the biggest fish is the one that you remember. It's true.
Well, the most memorable for me so far is, going off tangent now, brought my boys fly fishing for the first time. They were 3 and 5. And do you know where it was? It was in Prospect Park in the center of Brooklyn. So it's like the central.
In New York.
Yeah.
New York.
We were living there for a couple of months, a couple of years ago. And so Prospect Park is like the central park of Brooklyn. So, like, you know, you're surrounded by high-rise apartments and all that kind of stuff. And there's a lake in the middle. And there's bluegill fish. They're, like, literally that size. And so brought them fishing for the very first time. And, you know, they were catching, like, every cast they were catching, you know. And it was just flicking the line out. But seeing the absolute amazement, joy, I can't even sum it up. There's a picture I have. I took it. The fish is, you know, it's a little fella. He's on the side of the bank. And just the face of the kids was just like, you know, and that to me summed it up. If I can replicate that for them or sow that seed for them, you know, for hopefully that will be them hooked for life. And that to me is the most memorable fish so far.
But I think what has happened on Corrib is that in years past, people got into fishing, first fishing for perch, and then progressed from there on into trout or what have you. But when the size limit gets, Corrib is not an easy place to catch fish. Let's be quite blunt about it. It's quite difficult. And particularly now when various methods which might have been considered okay in the past are no longer, they're all being frowned upon now, and there's a sort of a begrudgery amongst fly fishermen, I suppose, against all other methods, which I don't subscribe to whatsoever. I mean, to me, all legal methods, as long as it's totally legal, is fair play. And I think that they're potentially squashing youth by denying them that satisfaction of catching a fish and, if necessary, eating it or winning a prize with it or what have you. I would go the opposite way. I'd say they should actually lower size limits, keep the number of fish that you can keep low, but allow a child to catch a 12-inch or even a 10-inch fish. I mean, quite frankly, if they're limited to the number they can take, it's going to have less impact than if they were to catch bigger fish. But that's just a personal point of view. I think kids need reward for their efforts, and Corrib is definitely not the place to do it at the moment. If you have a stock fishery, great. I would advocate a lot more small stock fisheries where kids can go and learn to fish, catch fish, And let them progress from that if they want the challenge. Certainly, Corb will do that.
You got to graduate to the University of Corb then.
Yeah, that's it.
Roy, thanks a million for your time. It's been absolutely fascinating, you know, getting the kind of
very good
trip down memory lane.
Don't forget that trout.
Well done, Roy.
Thanks, Roy. Fair play to you. Thanks a million. Our thanks to Roy Pearce for joining us on the show. So don't forget to rate, review, and follow the Ireland on the Fly podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.
Plus, you can keep up to date on IrelandOnTheFly.com as well as on Instagram. And myself and Tom will be back with another episode about the people and places of fly fishing in Ireland.